Thank you for joining us for another episode of Digitally Diverse, where we do a deep dive into the journeys and career of some influential people in the design and tech industry. So today we are joined by Ryan Whitmore, who is a senior product designer at ReadyTech. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Well, I guess I would love to start off with just a brief overview of like who you are, what you're up to at the moment, and how you've come to where you are at ReadyTech.
Cool. Well, currently based in Sydney, originally a Canberra guy. Over the last, I think, 5 or 6 years, I've been working in the design industry, coming up through UX pathways. Prior to that, I was doing stuff in the games industry, and I was also a teacher and dance teacher back down in Canberra, so a bit of a eclectic background. And yeah, life brought me up to Sydney with my partner for a job at Madpaws, as my first official product designer or first title as a product designer. Yeah, have been up here for about 2.5 years and joined at ReadyTech only about 2 months ago. So pretty new into my current role. Super keen in different adrenaline activities. I quite enjoy a good boulder, quite enjoy a good mountain bike sesh. Sad to say goodbye to the snowboarding of convenience down in Canberra, but loving it up in Sydney at the moment.
Love that. And I'd love to do a deep dive, but perhaps later, into your dancing teaching credentials. That's so cool. But what are you coming on board to ReadyTech to do? Is there any particular problems that you're facing at the moment?
Yeah, for sure. So the main remit for me joining ReadyTech is to sort of coach and support the growth and maturity and development of our product and design team, as well as other teams that work in conjunction with us. So historically, ReadyTech has been very development first. It's been clients will come to purchase the product, ask for particular functionality and features, deliver those requirements, and then the team would go forth and develop those. In terms of the vision for how the product comes together and it makes sense down the line, all that sort of jazz. This is kind of a new way of working, a new way of thinking for the company and for the product team. And so it's been being built up over the last maybe year or two. And then I was brought in as someone to really help the product designers in our team, which focuses in the education space, on how to get us working within like product trios, doing human-centered design, speaking to users a lot more regularly, running continuous discovery habits, going through a discover, define, design, deliver cycle, I guess, good old Marty Kagan stuff, all those sorts of things. and yeah, just really trying to help set that up, bit of a design process establishment, which has been, I guess, my core remit in the first 3 months. And then beyond then, it's design system, as well as continuing to mature those processes and those practices.
Yeah, nice. So really like taking the reins on the HCD side of things and figuring out what that looks like for you guys. I'm curious, were you able to share just a bit of a overview of what ReadyTech does? Like what kind of product it is?
Yeah, for sure. So ReadyTech is a company that's been around for quite a while, actually. It was started back in the 90s and was publicly listed not too long ago. Diversifies its portfolio across education, work pathways, workforce solutions. There's some court software in there and like council software and that sort of stuff as well. And the main focus of the company is to provide like mission critical software that enables businesses and services to run. In terms of where I work, it's in the education and work pathways team, which creates learning pathways or like learning management systems, student management systems, so on and so forth. And I work on a student management system called JR Plus. Yeah, it really ties in with government regulations and different education goals. It's used for vet courses, apprenticeships, higher education as well, TAFEs, et cetera, et cetera. So they're the main, I guess, training organizations that we support. But at the end of the day, the end user that we're really trying to elevate and serve here is, you know, the students or the people that are accessing that education and the quality of the education that comes out of that.
Yeah, nice. No, that's great. Thank you. So, Ryan, what kind of projects and challenges are you guys facing at ReadyTech at the moment?
Yeah, so ReadyTech is currently working on a number of different things spread across like client requests. So we're doing things in terms of the product team specifically, I guess, is supporting the onboarding or the implementation of the software with a number of different providers of all different sizes. So there's some small like Ma and Pa setups that are implementing JR Plus. Then there are some much bigger organizations as well, larger institutes, TAFEs, higher education, that are taking particular sections or parts of the product. Outside of that, and more in the product space, we're working on a couple of key areas that have been identified as like strong growth sections. So it's really looking at the whole experience around how do we get students on board? How do we support the employers as well as the, because often it's like an apprenticeship. So how do we support the employers with that whole process? How do we enable the best support through that process? So that's communication of information, that's training plans, that's, you know, getting people enrolled and admitted into courses. And sort of looking at the whole end-to-end experience as well and trying to genuinely understand, well, you know, there's three different, I guess, user needs in this space, right? You have the training provider, you then have the employer, and then you have the student, which is often a staff member as well. And so they're all sort of driving for different reasons, right? They're all trying to train the student at the end. But in terms of things that are prevalent for them, like the employer is also trying to manage their day-to-day business. So how do they cover the cost of that, as well as how do they cover the time of the student going in and doing their apprenticeship, and how do they play around? Like, how do they manage that? So that's something that we're spending quite a bit of time building empathy and understanding for, so that we're able to solve those problems specifically, some of those more granular specific problems, but the bigger ones in terms of, you know, really connected learning goals across the student's journey. Also like smooth delivery of courses as well, because this software not only like manages a student's progress, but it also is involved in like attendance marking and all those sorts of things as well. So if you have apprentices that are coming in at all hours of the day because of their work schedule, how can we make it as least impactful to the students, to the trainers, I guess, classes, and ultimately the students' learning experiences, to have those attendance records marked and then to also take those students to the specific areas, because, you know, apprenticeships is usually learning how to use dangerous equipment or learning how to do, you know, a pretty complicated hands-on activity, right? It's a bit different to I myself that was sort of learning how to use design tools and those sort of things. There's not as much like risk there, right? So there's work health and safety and all those sort of things need to be managed. And quite interestingly, the software that we build has a tangible impact on their ability to do that. So it's really looking at those whole like end-to-end experiences and understanding how we can have like almost invisible software that really serves its core purpose whilst ensuring that we're able to meet government like compliance and regulation needs and setting students up for success.
Yeah, no, that sounds like quite the pickle, really, because you're having to kind of make the process and the experience seamless for people who have got really different reasons for using the product. So how are you going about that? What kind of research and testing are you doing for that?
Yeah, like great question, because not only do we have the difference between industries, right? But then you also have the difference between roles within industries, and different providers focus on different things and they use different aspects of the product also in different ways. So the current model that ReadyTech has in terms of approaching serving those clients' needs is to really understand what it is that they want in the request for the product, and then figure out how we can implement it in a way that repurposes particular bits of functionality. However, that sort of creates a new problem for us as a product, which is you start getting a little bit of a patchwork quilt, right? And you get new things that are built that might only be for that particular client's specific use case, which is very difficult for it to be one, a coherent product many years in the future, but two, also relevant for different clients. So we're introducing continuous discovery habits, which is a book written by Teresa Torres, which ties in quite nicely with Marty Kagan's books, and something that I had set up or sort of took a lot of inspiration from in my previous role as well, and really trying to ensure that we're speaking to users every single week and giving teams a period of time to go in and do a bit of a discovery piece if that's relevant. There's a brilliant little matrix that Dovetail had up on one of their articles. For those listeners that don't know Dovetail, it's a research repository. It's a great little tool. And it has like a matrix of what's the problem clarity and what's the risk level. And if it's a really high risk but really low problem clarity, then it's something that's probably a good candidate for doing deeper research pieces. So we're spending a lot of time with our product teams to help them think critically about how well do we actually know this problem space, how much do we empathize and understand the different users' realities, and also looking at it from a viability lens as well and being like, well, how complicated do we think this is going to be to solve or build? And from there, we make a decision as to how deep we dive into research. Currently, because it's quite new in the business, we're running a lot of user interviews. They're anywhere from 45 minutes to probably about an hour, and typically cover their lived experience with completing that thing, that job, right? And yeah, the jobs to be done framework, another buzzword, I guess, is something that we're also using quite a bit too, to just frame, you know, like it's business to business software, right? So it's helping us frame what it is they're trying to complete and how we can structure that employee's jobs, that employee's work experience in a really easy to tackle way. Yeah. And iterative development, right? So take the concepts, you take the learnings, and you try and pull out the key insights, the key learnings. You challenge your thinking, your biases, your assumptions. You define some nice, clear problems. And then from that, you surface some concepts and some ideas and quickly iterate and test on those with prototypes. So that's obviously pretty high level. I'm sure most designers typically will say that kind of process. But in terms of the way that the teams were operating when I first joined ReadyTech, it was mostly business requirements driven, writing out tickets and having some prototypes, but not everything was prototyped. And then often the developers would support with the designing of the experience as well, which is great. We absolutely want tech involvement, but it did also mean that there was often misinterpretations sometimes between the words, right? So it's really just trying to get the design process nice and visual.
Mm-hmm.
Because the thinking and the logic and all the understanding that underpins all of the work that's been done up to date is really solid. It's just communicating it in a visual way that allows us to keep the product continuity there, and most importantly, keep that user experience consistent across the product and to a vision that's going to be good too.
Sounds pretty meaty. Like, there's obviously so many different aspects to what you guys are trying to achieve. Do you have a dedicated research team, or is it all the designers are pretty much like working end to end with this?
Yeah, so it's definitely the latter.
Typical startup vibes, yeah.
And like ReadyTech is definitely not a startup anymore. But in terms of, you know, like you spoke about what are some of the problems and the challenges we're facing, I think it's a pretty common one across most businesses, but inflation and the way that the economy is doing at the moment is having a very tangible impact on how much investment can be put into sort of, I guess, growth-focused teams, and quite often product is growth-focused. So when we're looking at the skill sets we bring on board, having like a dedicated research team is something that is probably a bridge too far in terms of where we need to put our money, I guess, and what humans and what skill sets we need. So it's definitely much more of a jack of all trades sort of product designer, someone who definitely stretches across that spectrum as opposed to discrete functions. But I also think it's very personally, I have a bit of a mantra that, you know, a product designer, it's kind of like they're the equivalent of a full stack dev, right?
Mm-hmm.
That means being able to go from deep discovery all the way through to high fidelity delivery of designs, right? And working in lockstep with engineers to bring whatever the solution is to life, right? And make sure the problem stays true. In terms of solving the problem, it stays true. So I think that designers should absolutely be doing their own research, you know, obviously to a certain extent, in terms of innovative, just going off and doing completely generative, open-ended research. That's probably not necessary for product designers. But when you're coming in to work on an outcome, solve a problem space, or find a really valid solution for an opportunity space, product designers should be speaking to users at all points through there. So it's really just mostly about understanding the outcome box that we're in at the moment, conducting the necessary discovery research. So that's mostly contextual inquiries and understanding their context, their experience,
mm-hmm.
and then quickly transitioning into doing more prototype-driven usability testing, that sort of stuff. But the goal would be to get to doing some deeper, more open-ended research that can surface some unknown unknowns, right?
Yeah, I mean, that, I guess that's always the goal, but whether or not it's practical for where you all are at the moment, that's another question. So,
yeah,
it's interesting to hear that that's kind of like where your priority is at the moment, having someone who's abreast of every aspect of the process. So, and you're right, like I tend to find here in Australia anyway, that's more common to have someone who's a jack or a Jill of all trades, where they're after someone who's, you know, really able to speak to every part of the design process and know what they're talking about. Overseas, it does tend to be a little bit more specialized, but that also comes with other cons as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I've definitely seen before like silos that have arisen from having dedicated research teams and stuff. So I think starting where we're at today is a very like logical or pragmatic approach, because it develops knowledge and experience over that whole product design lifecycle, I guess. For us, like it's a very different dynamic. Like this organization is a very different dynamic to my previous role. It was business to customer in my previous role, where this is business to business. And so client relationships and sort of that sales role is much more prevalent, whereas in the customer focused is more marketing and, you know, what's the societal interpretation of the product and how can that be interpreted and understood through our digital experiences and our content and so on. And so that just has very different impact on the types of people you interact with within the company and the different things people need to get involved in and like the checks and balances for different things as well, to make sure that, you know, you don't accidentally kick over a glass or something like that when you're trying to do user research or something and cause an accidental issue or problem,
mm-hmm.
because it's a different dynamic.
Yeah, no, I guess with your experience, like you've obviously now at a B2B company, were working at MadPaws, which is B2C. And then prior to that, you were in consulting, right?
Mm-hmm.
How have you found the transitioning from each of those workplaces? Because they're all, you're right, they all are quite different.
Noticeable.
Yeah.
It's probably a good way to put it. So my first job in industry was at DXC Technology. The transition from DXC to PwC was probably the closest. They're both obviously consulting firms, but just slightly different points of focus.
Mm-hmm.
That transition was unique just due to the size of PwC and the specificity of my role. So in DXC, I was more of a UX designer and I was working on digital transformation, which, you know, buzzwords galore, but that is effectively just a team coming in and working.
Consulting.
Yeah. Coming in and working with an organization to be like, you guys want to use more technology or you want to try and change the way you do a process or do work. Let us help you figure that out. And so that was kind of end-to-end like a product designer. But when I joined PwC, I was much more like I was a strategic designer. So that very much had me in the let's sort of discover the problem and let's talk about recommendations and the solutions, conduct a lot of research, do some BA style work, but also do a lot of user facing work and try and bring that together to give you a path or a roadmap to doing something new, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then the transition to Madpaws. Actually, my first 3 to 4 months at Madpaws was for their product called Dinner Bowl, which is like a dog food subscription product. So you could, yeah. So it's brand spanking new. It's kind of what really helped Madpaws get through the start of COVID, because when COVID hit, the core business for Madpaws was people getting pet sitters to look after their animal when they were on holidays or going away. So obviously when we're all locked down, that's not happening. So pretty much everything from Madpaws ground to a really, really quick halt. And everybody just wrapped around this concept of dinner bowl, you know, dog food subscription, cooked to all the necessary nutritional values, human grade, delivered to your door, made specifically for your dog's energy levels and their size, et cetera, et cetera. And so that really helps the business, like the company, stay afloat and keep the lights on, so to speak. And then as things start to back up, we're able to do more things. But that was the team that I started with. And that was much more like e-commerce almost. And that was very different to what I'd been doing, right? So I'd started my career in sort of, let's go through the double diamond process and let's try and discover all the problems to, oh, this thing's performing really well in socials. We've got really good metrics on this particular thing. Let's update the website so it has it looking like this or has it looking like that. And that was a very different pace to what I was used to working at. It was also a very different motivator or instigator of work too. It took me a little bit of wrapping my head around like how I was able to work in a product way within that framework, I guess. And I did struggle with that, but ultimately, I learned a lot of good things in terms of conversion and retention. For those that are listening who are new, I didn't know what these numbers meant, but conversion is how many people you can get to buy. Retention is how many people you can keep buying, is an easy way to think about it. And sort of how those metrics drove a lot of business, right? And that started to get me to think about like the outcomes and key results framework and how we can start to think about those business metrics and turn them into product metrics. And fortunately, got to do some things where we were redesigning the whole homepage, which saw a 30% uplift in conversion, which is huge, right? So it was that instilled a bit of confidence in me and sort of the product process. And then I, a few months after that, I ended up moving on to the core product, which was our marketplace. And that was once again entirely different. It was much bigger. I was trying to figure that out. And then my transition to ReadyTech, in terms of, I guess, role similarities or fundamentals, probably a better way to put it, it hasn't really been different at all, right? Which has kind of been nice. The bigger challenge for me personally is just the level of responsibility. Being in industry now for five, six years, however long it's been. And, you know, prior to that, I have many years teaching, as we sort of alluded to before. So there's different sort of skill sets that have been built up in previous careers. I'm now in that position where I'm coaching and mentoring and helping do almost the change transformation stuff that I was doing at the beginning of my career, but sort of I'm the change agent, so to speak. And it's just different.
It's gonna come full circle.
It has a little bit. And so it's quite interesting because it gives me respect for just the pure complexity of driving change in any organization, no matter the size of it, right? And something I've been saying to my colleagues, my managers, is learning to become comfortable being uncomfortable, because I am not there yet is the simple answer of the fact. And it's about going, okay, well, I know I'm very confident in the way of working that is my foundation and the approach that I know has worked. And it's worked really well in previous roles. And so I'm really confident with what we're bringing in to ReadyTech, but it also means that sometimes there are tough conversations, right? And you've got to find compromises too, right? You can't just go purist the whole time, because let's face it, no company is purist. No workplace is purist in that sense. So it's like going, okay, well, this is what we want to do. but we're not going to get there straight away. So just being fair, being reasonable, being practicing what you preach, right? Like we spend so much time speaking to users and empathizing with their needs. If we're doing change internally, it should be exactly the same. Speaking with our colleagues, speaking with our teams, empathizing with their understanding and flexing that so that we're able to grow together and grow meaningfully, as opposed to people possibly getting annoyed or jaded or something because you force change at a rate that's not appropriate.
That's definitely something that comes up a lot when I speak with, especially over the last few years, design teams and what they look like. Companies in general have changed a lot, and how we work has changed a lot as well. That the people who are the happiest with their experience have always been the people who have been consulted and had that collaboration piece with their managers and their mentors, and have really been asked, you know, what works best for you and how do you want to see this change be put into place? And you're right, there's no point in putting, you know, a square peg into a triangle hole. Like, you've got to figure out what is going to work best with each workplace. So yeah, kudos to you for like actually asking the questions. I think that's great.
Well, trying, right? Yeah. There's always room for improvement. Like, you know, I often reflect on stuff that I've been doing over the last couple of months, right? And there's absolutely, you know, ways that I could approach things in different levels, right? But I think that's also a part of the new role that I'm into, and that transition challenge that we were talking to before, like being able to reflect on that and be like, oh, I asked this question or I took this approach, but I don't know if that landed exactly how I wanted it to. So, you know, being selfless and self-effacing as well to a certain extent, and, you know, just being like, this is my intention. It fell flat. I'm sorry. Let's try that again, which I've had a couple of those moments.
Yeah, and we all do. Like, and it makes sense that you'd want to, especially when you're quite new, you've only been there for a few months, like it's gonna feel weird for a while. And I was actually speaking to, I think it was my sister, she and I asked her, like, how long does it usually take you to fit into a new role and feel like you know what, where you were at and how you were doing? And probably about a year, I think, is the consensus. Like, it seems to me that that's kind of when everyone seems to hit their stride and they feel a bit comfortable and they know all of the stakeholders. So yeah, I think it just takes a bit of time. Yeah.
And it's also just really complicated for anybody in new roles generally, because business typically wants you to start making moves or delivering value much sooner than 12 months, right? So
yeah,
I had an OKR, personal OKR, to start doing design process in 3 months, right? So it's like, okay, right, I'll jump into doing that. But that also means that, you know, you've got to start making some decisions to move in that direction before you possibly know every ounce of context. So it's a constant juggling act. And, you know, to bring it back to your original question in terms of transition, that's definitely been and continues to be the most challenging part, because I've gone from being a product designer that lives within a product trio. For the listeners that don't know what I'm referring to there, that is a product manager, a product designer, and a tech lead that work together to make sure we're trying to solve the right problems. And then we have a team that wraps around us that we support that helps build that solution or whatever it is. And so I've gone from being in a role where I was a product designer in that, leading the research functions at Madpaws, but like I was still delivering things, to being across multiple teams and not actually delivering anything directly. I'm supporting teams and stepping in and stepping out as needed, which is just a very different context as well. So yeah, it could be really challenging to balance stepping up into sort of, whether it be from uni to junior, junior to mid to senior, whatever, stepping up into those different roles. But it can also be difficult to manage your own interpretations of what the expectations are of your performance in a period of time, with sort of how long, like you and your sister said, it takes to really feel fully connected to the company. And it's not just the company, right? Because you're trying to understand the product. And then most importantly, you're trying to connect with all the people as well, right? And find your place in the culture and have purpose, and not be annoying, but also be likable and fun and, you know, but be yourself and all those sorts of things.
That old chestnut. I know, right? It's a juggling act for sure. So yeah, Ryan, I think you mentioned before, like, you know, transitioning from uni into the junior role, into the mid, and how you've been finding that transition now into somewhat leading a team. I guess I'm curious to hear what compelled you to come into design and to tech in the first place. So did you have a uni experience with design, and what did that look like?
So yes, I had a form of higher education experience with design, but I didn't go to a university, so to speak. So I was studying primary school teaching, then I moved to high school teaching, and I was working as a facilitator of dance class in a school at the same time as I was studying full time. So I was teaching and studying, as well as doing some learning support assistance in classrooms in that role. And that timeline there, because I'd been teaching and I'd been running classes and I'd been, you know, doing a lot of that work, I tried to get my university to give me RPL or some form of recognition for doing effectively placement for however long it was.
Mm-hmm.
But for understandable reasons, the system wasn't going to allow that. And I just got really frustrated. So I was like, and it also aligned with some life things at the time in terms of having to sort of pause my degree. And I decided to then study something for a couple of years online that I could do at a more part-time rate. Mm-hmm. And that was when I stumbled across design as a space. So for whatever reason, actually, funny story, if you'll entertain a bit of a digression or a tangent.
Please do.
I was playing an online computer game and I kept getting into a public lobby with this other guy. Anyway, we started chatting and I jumped on a video voice call with him at one point and we started talking more. He happened to live in Canberra as well. And I was like, oh, what do you do? Da, 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 da. And he's like, oh, I'm studying how to become a games developer. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. So then I went in and I started having a bit of a look around at this particular training organization called the Academy of Interactive Entertainment. I really liked the description of game design. And so I decided to sign up off the back of that and ended up meeting him in person. I'm still good mates with him all the way up to today. And we've done a few little sort of small side gigs together and helped each other out here and there. And that's ultimately what made me fall in love with design, right? So I studied teaching at the University of Canberra, which ultimately was, from a financial perspective, a waste of a degree, unfortunately. So still paying off a portion of that. And then I had my debt, I guess, for the course at AIE. So a bit of a unexpected path. I didn't really know exactly what it was that I wanted to be doing. But when I started doing game design, what really drew me to it was thinking about how do I build a fun experience that feels connected and feels somewhat believable. So there are a few things in game design, like some just core concepts like the way you design a mechanic. So like, you know, how do you, say, in Skyrim, use your magic ability? Like, how does that do its thing? But then there are also economies that sit around that. So, like, when you use a magic ability, your mana goes down. How much does it go down? And, like, what happens with your health? And all those sorts of different things. And that creates gameplay loops and experiences. As you do something, there's, you know, an inverse action and you interact with the world through those things. And so I really enjoyed that sort of system design and that thinking about how that experience comes together and then being creative, getting to build a fun experience. And like, I'd always been somebody that was a little bit like, oh, university degrees are a bit silly and annoying. Like you have to get this piece of paper to then be employed. And as soon as I got my piece of paper, I kid you not, DXC then hit me up and asked if I was interested in applying for a UX designer role. I didn't even know what UX design was at the time. So had my game design background, got my piece of paper, and then within a week or so, I started going through the process for that. So I was very, very privileged, very, very fortunate to sort of have the cards fall in that manner. That's sort of ultimately what got me into UX design, coming from the games background. But it felt like a really almost poetic combination of interests and skill sets, because I really loved, from my dance background, putting together pieces and stories and narratives, right, through dance, through movement. And then with games, I really liked making an experience connected and easy to use and enjoyable and engaging. And then UX design is kind of those things all smashed together a little bit. Obviously not one-to-one, but like more so than I expected. And then, yeah, just empathizing with people and understanding their needs and then interpreting that and coming up with a solution just really got me sort of hooked in the space and the industry. And yeah, for a little while there, I tried to get back into games. It's a bit of a fickle industry in and of itself. You sort of need to be in it to be in it. And if you don't sort of start at the bottom, it's hard to move sideways into the industry. And so over the last few years, I've really just had to sort of make an intentional decision that, you know, product and this industry is sort of my focus area, right? So have those skill sets in games, which is absolutely translatable. I lean on it all the time, but I haven't gone through like a formal visual design or graphics design course or something like that. I also had never done a general assembly or any of those styles of courses in terms of what is UX design. When I was at DXC, I did get to do a IDEO service design course, which was actually really helpful. But that was something that, you know, was supported through my role and helped extend my skills at that point in time. So,
yeah, it's really interesting to hear from people that don't have the, you know, traditional bachelor's degree. And you're right, it's quite trendy right now to go through General Assembly. And it's, I think, really cool that you've come in from a different industry. It happens quite a lot. I hear all the time with people coming in from like a marketing background or like a traditional design or
customer support or something like that.
Yeah, because you're right. They are translatable skills. So yeah, it's interesting to hear what you love so much about like gaming and, you know, that cause and effect and how all that ties in with like UX, because UX is so much about like, you know, the experience and making sure that you're getting that that impact with the user. It's very, very translatable. You're right.
Yeah. And I didn't click in my mind for years, like for years and years. So like I'd been doing design for quite a while, and I reckon probably only in the last 2 years, two and a little bit years, that relationship between it has properly clicked. I think stepping into a product design role where you're thinking about, I guess, the business metrics that move and the human metrics and all those sort of things, there's that connection as well. And it makes it feel a little bit more tangible in the sense that building these experiences because of these reasons, and we're trying to solve these problems, but they're valuable problems to be solved because they're moving these numbers, which result in better outcomes, right? And those outcomes are product outcomes that are focused on the human that you're trying to help, not necessarily business outcomes that's often focused on money or some sort of growth metric for the organization. Because for me personally, that doesn't really resonate. I don't really care too much about, well, this thing I did generated $200,000 or whatever, like, okay, cool. Did I help this person get their whatever, right? Like did I allow this pet to have a good life for a couple of weeks whilst their family was away? You know, like what was the righteous thing, I guess, that we're enabling through the product, right? So having those outcomes that do relate to the business metrics, which whether we like it or not, are important. You know, if we don't have the money being generated for this stuff, then we're not going to have the work in the first place. So you do have to draw those connections. But if we're able to see the meaningful change to the humans that the product is here to serve, and in Madpaws's case, the animals, that's a much more motivating factor for me personally.
Yeah. And it seems to be more and more important for designers these days to have that positive impact on the users or the customers or whoever you're trying to serve. Is that one of the main reasons why you wanted to go to ReadyTech? Because you feel like you'd have a bit more of a wider range of users that you'd be able to help?
I think for me, with the move to ReadyTech, it was really about the next step in my career, you know, being ambitious and wanting the opportunity to sort of shape the way a design team is able to operate. That was probably the core focus, I guess, in terms of that. But the second and very close to equal was the fact it was in the education space in terms of my role, and having that background in education. Like I obviously nearly did that as a job, right? So I do care about that, and I do get a lot of satisfaction out of seeing people thrive and the process of finding what thrive looks like for those people. So be that an extension of the level of role I have at ReadyTech, or be that an extension of the product and what that enables in terms of students studying and thriving in their own careers, it's sort of one and the same. Those two things were the biggest draw for me in terms of moving to ReadyTech.
Yeah, I love that full circle moment yet again.
Yeah.
So Ryan, obviously you've had a few chops and changes with like your direction and like what you've studied and where you wanted to see yourself going. Has that kind of affected like some speed bumps that you've had in your career? Like what, has there been any moments where you've had to take stock and really figure out where you want to be heading?
The most pertinent one that comes to mind before entering, or I guess choosing to study game design, was I was feeling really stuck in the whole teaching situation. I mentioned before when I was talking about my education pathways that I tried to get the university to recognize the work I'd been doing in the school. And that really got me down. I was, you know, there were times where I was like, fortunately, I was really lucky. I had my own little office in the school for some reason. I don't know why, but I did. And so like, yeah, there were a couple of points in time where I was just really overwhelmed. And so I just closed the door and I had a cry. Like I was pretty upset. Didn't know what I wanted to do or why I should go down a particular path. And I was also, you know, really quite scared of the games path. Like I just, you know, you only ever hear that it's a challenging industry to get into and that it's very competitive and that Australia is really bad with its games industry. So I was just scared that I was making a really bad choice in terms of career pathway, and to go from something so, I guess, necessary as education to I'm going to become somebody that makes computer games. It was just like, it was a really scary concept. And I had no idea that it was going to lead on this path. I had no idea that it was going to connect to something like UX. And so that was a big speed bump that intimidated the living bejeevers out of me. But my mum just encouraged me to jump into it, and of which I did. And I'm very, very grateful and glad that I've done that. Then I guess speed bumps throughout my career, you know, I guess I have a caveat that, you know, I think I have a huge amount of privilege. There's definitely a massive amount of luck and societal sort of privilege, I think, that has come my way as a result of, you know, like getting my degree and then very quickly being approached for a job, mm-hmm. my age being a little bit older as an entry level and that sort of stuff, being white, being male, being tall, all those sort of things, I think have had a very unconscious impact on maybe being unconsciously seen a little bit more. So I try to be very self-aware of that and very supportive of everybody else, and always try to caveat, I guess, my path as well, because I know some people just don't have that, right? And unfortunately, that's something that we're trying to change as a broader society, but it's really hard for those individuals. So I'm grateful for that, but it has had a big impact, I think. So besides for the stuff in terms of choosing my degrees, I was at PwC and I very quickly realized that that as an organization wasn't a culture fit for me. And that was a pretty big speed bump. That took a really big hit on my mental health. Previous to that role as well, I had always put a lot of self-worth on my professional aptitude and my professional effort, I guess. And then I got to PwC and it's just different organization, different hierarchy. It works really well for some people, but it just didn't work well for me. I felt like I wasn't listened to and I wasn't given the runway to sort of stretch, flex, fail, succeed, et cetera, et cetera. Also, COVID had happened at that point in time as well. So there was a lot of being at home and just the stress of that whole time frame. So that had a pretty big impact on my mental health. But what ultimately resulted from that was a complete reframing of what I valued and why I valued things. And if I'm to be a glass half full kind of guy, like I think it very much made me value my now fiance, but at the time, it was an early relationship between the two of us, and it really made me value and appreciate her a lot more, and what we gave each other and supported each other. And, you know, even things like my personal hobbies, very much into mountain biking, I did a lot more of that. And so there was health and well-being that came as a result of that. But the work satisfaction was much, much lower. I also experienced a little bit of bullying in that particular role as well, which is a bit of a tough thing to talk about, but that was something I did experience a bit of. And so that process, in terms of, you know, going through HR as well as just experiencing it in general, was not nice. That knocked my confidence around quite a lot. And it also meant that when I joined Madpaws, there was a really, really, really long sort of runway to rebuilding and reestablishing my professional identity, because I'd also gone from this point of view where I was no longer valuing myself personally on my aptitude and my effort in the work context. And I'd lost a lot of self-esteem because of that whole experience. And then I stepped into this other company where it was very, very different. Culture was more aligned to my personality. The size was like literally the inverse. I think I joined Madpaws when it was like 35 people or something. So much, much smaller than the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people that work for PwC. So like all of that was quite a big change, I think. And so there was months of, I guess, just rebuilding and trusting myself, and trying a few things and pushing the boundaries, you know, being vulnerable, you know, with my new colleagues at the time, and allowing myself to, I guess, feel a bit crappy at times as well, and to be really as open as I felt comfortable with my managers and the people around me about what was going on at that point in time as well, and letting them know that I'd had those experiences in my previous role and how I thought it was manifesting for me in my current role. So yeah, that would probably be the biggest speed bump. And, you know, the reason I told the story in terms of my privilege is because I kind of feel like that's a big speed bump for me personally, but that's just a singular speed bump, right? There's lots of other speed bumps that I know colleagues that I've crossed paths with, people I've worked with in consulting and all sorts of things, different professions, backgrounds, pathways, everything have had more speed bumps than me in regards to that. So I always try to keep myself grounded, I guess, when it comes to those things. I learned a lot from that experience, which is very much shaped how I want to be as a human and a professional forever from here on out, like really consolidated that part of me, I guess. And fortunately for me, the manager I had for the longest period of time at Madpaws was somebody who really embodied that as well. And so that really helped me gravitate towards it and do it more. And also, you know, he's somebody that I stay in contact with a lot now. He's just a fantastic guy. And, you know, he supports me and mentors me a little bit with different stages of where I'm at with my career too. So yeah.
Yeah. First of all, thanks for being like super vulnerable with your experience and being aware with what kind of privileges come from, you know, where we live and who we are, but then also acknowledging and reflecting on the fact that no one gets a easy breezy, super cruisy journey through their career, and everyone does have speed bumps, and reflecting on that and you then knowing how you want to show up then as a leader and as a colleague is, you know, obviously it's a crappy situation when you're in the midst of it, but coming out the other end and realizing like, okay, this is how I want this to shape with where I go next is really powerful. So yeah, nice.
Yeah, exactly. And like I something I try to do as well is like I don't want to villainize the other people that were in that situation as well, in terms of I guess the perpetrator, if you want to use that kind of language, like their intent, I don't believe was ever to do that. It's just that's how it came across and that's how it impacted me. So, you know, I try to be optimistic about those situations, and that whether it's true or not is, you know, potentially a different story, but in my mind, that's what is a healthier way of framing it. call it naive, call it whatever, I'm not sure. But I think, you know, giving people the benefit of the doubt and, you know, giving people the opportunity to grow or to change or whatever it is just a good personality trait, generally speaking. So I try to make sure that my mindset doesn't go down dark paths or anything like that when it comes to reflecting on those things.
Mm-hmm. And I think as well, it's really good to talk about this stuff because the experience of bullying, it doesn't stop at school.
No.
Which I think a lot of people, when they hear that word, that's immediately what comes to mind. So thanks for being super vulnerable and like sharing your experience, because I feel like a lot of people can probably empathize with that. And also that self-doubt as well when it comes to that situation. It does matter how it lands. Like,
yeah, it does.
Whether or not the intent was there. So, yeah, I think that's a really important conversation to have.
Yeah. One other thing that just popped into my head as you were talking is something that helped me move on, which is why I wanted to jump in and add it, is that something I learned is that sometimes a place is just not your place, right? Like the value that you bring might actually objectively not be good in that place. And that's a hard reality to personally accept.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes that's not because of you as an individual, it's because of that place not being your place, right? And going to find a shared group of people, right? Like you can't be friends with everybody in the world. You find your group, right? You find people with similar mindset. I think work is still the same. Like you don't necessarily, you're always going to work with people that are a little bit different. You're going to have challenges and those sort of things. But as a company culture and as a thing that really allows you to thrive and allows you to be your best self as a human personally, but also as a professional as well, like everybody has their place. And I think that was a big lesson for me.
Mm-hmm.
That PwC was great. It was some people's place and it was a really good learning experience for me, but it wasn't my place. And it resulted in some poor experiences. And I could have been objectively bad in some ways in that particular role. I don't know whether I was. I didn't think I was, at least at the time. But, you know, there could have been people with that interpretation, right? And I do think that that ultimately comes back to me not really feeling like that was where I belonged, right? So that's been really helpful for me. And I also think it's a powerful thing for me to acknowledge, because when I stepped into Mad Paws, it felt much more like my place.
Mm-hmm.
ReadyTech much more as well, right? Similar level to Madpaw, is just a different flavor. So that was just a life lesson, a really hard one to learn. But it was a life lesson that I think is important for people to hear. At least I feel it's important for people to hear.
Yeah. It's a conversation I have with quite a few different people. They get, I think with every role, it's kind of like relationships. Like you figure out what you don't want and then you move on, figure out, and then you just kind of like whittle it down until you're in a really good spot. But then that also changes as well. So there's no right or wrong answer. I think it's just figuring out where you fit.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
So Ryan, kind of going from that, is there anything that, like any activities or books or mentors that you love listening to or get advice from that has kind of helped you out throughout your journey?
My previous manager at Mad Paws, Mike Yap, he's someone who has had a massive impact on my mindset, massive impact on my career path. And I've really, really appreciated my time working with him and the opportunity to be under his guidance. He's a designer that stepped up into a head of product role. And I feel like a lot of the times head of products tend to come from a product management perspective. And so having a product designer in that position, I felt was really refreshing. And it really helped my perspective and what I was trying to stand for be heard. And his approach was just unbelievably empathetic. He would always listen first, acknowledge what you had said, and then have a constructive conversation as to where that might objectively stand, and drawing very clear boundaries around that, which, you know, when you're trying to solve problems like we do in the product design space. And there's often pretty strong ideas and concepts and opinions about how you might go about that. Or there might be big money tied to a particular thing. People can get really attached or motivated or sometimes personal, not often, but sometimes personal about particular things. And so being able to have a boss, a mentor, a friend that I could be really raw with and tell him where I was at and know that that was a safe space, I valued so unbelievably highly. I'm also a talker, as you might have realized from this podcast anyway, as my current manager, Chris, says, I might use 48 words to say something that could be done in 15. So like for me, coming back to my place, my people, culture, that sort of stuff, like having that, we can laugh at it. I know I do it right. But also having that not pushed down or shunned or something like that and having it sort of channeled, I really, really valued and I really, really appreciated. Helps me see myself through a different light as well, but then helps me realize that, that's not, sometimes it's inefficient, but it's not a bad habit necessarily, right? So, I've very much expressed to him my gratitude for the time that we've had to work together, and I do stay in contact with him. So he's been very helpful for my career in the last couple of years.
Nice. Oh, good. It's always nice to have a bit of a shout out to some of the leaders that have shaped us. And yeah, it's great that you guys still get on and still chat. I'd like to finish off with one last question, if you don't mind, which I like to ask to everyone. If you could give your younger self some career advice, what would that be?
It's probably the advice I did receive from my parents, and it is trust your gut. It's a little bit ironic. Some of the people I've worked with probably chuckle at that because I'm very scientific in my method in terms of design, like what's the evidence, why are we doing it? But in terms of what draws you to a role, in terms of the reason why you feel you need to move on or the reason why you feel this would be good for you, even if you're not able to articulate it, to trust your gut. That is a very general statement, but it seems like the right thing for me to go and study games. Did I know I was going to end up here? Absolutely no. No way. Not at all. Right? It seemed like it was the right thing for me to move to PwC. It was another step. I was going to learn more things. Was it the end spot for me? No, absolutely not. Did I learn a lot? Absolutely, right? So, moving on from Madpaws was really, really challenging, right? Because it's been a company that helps me re-identify myself as a professional. Did I want to leave? No, right? But I knew it was time, and ReadyTech was a good opportunity for me, right? And I trusted my gut with that. So it's a statement that applies to personal as well as professional. And sometimes you sort of just know a thing is going to be right or is going to work. You can't articulate it, but you kind of just know. And sometimes to go back to even like famous people like Jim Carrey or something, like I manifest the thing, I manifested the role, right? Like if you have that intention or you have that belief that what you're doing has purpose and you trust in yourself for doing that, I think that might have a part to play in it. I don't know if it does. I don't even get any of the stuff behind that, but maybe that has a part to play in it. So.
Mm-hmm. No, thank you. And that seems to be a piece of advice that a lot of our guests have. So it's broad, but it can also be super duper specific. So it's interesting to hear why that matters so much to you. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.